Bart is a big expert on random geometry, and is one of the few which can actually do numerical calculations and very mathematical systems. And right now he's in Paris at the Institut de Physique Théorique or something.
Yes, correct.
Welcome, Timothy. And he will tell us about the numerical side of random geometries.
Or the geometrical side of numerics. Because so far, I guess in the past 2 days, we've seen various numerical methods, especially centered on the easing model. So the main goal of these lectures will be to show that the methods that Gerard Barkema told us for the easing model are actually very similar to the methods one can use to say something about quantum gravity. And I've split up this set of lectures into two parts. Today I'll just do two-dimensional random geometry. And arguably, Monte Carlo simulations in two-dimensional random geometry are even simpler than simulating the two-dimensional easing model. And you've all simulated the two-dimensional easing model on Monday, I think. So in principle, during the tutorial sessions, we could do the same. We could simulate two-dimensional random geometries. That would be certainly viable. I want to take a slightly different approach. What we're going to do through the tutorial sessions is that I'm going to give you a black box, a computer program that spits out random geometries. And you're going to try to catch these random geometries, and you're going to study them. Because simulating random geometries is one thing. But actually, getting a random geometry and then understanding what its properties are is another thing. And this will be an important goal of these lectures as well, to tell you what we can actually do when somebody throws a random geometry at you. I should mention that I've put up a dedicated web page at this address. It has the slides of these lectures, or at least the slides of the first part. Second part are still not completely 100% finished. I hope they'll appear there tomorrow before 8:45. And it also contains the software that you'll need for the tutorial sessions. I'll go into the details towards the end of these two lectures today. OK, so this is a two-dimensional random geometry. And these will be the kind of things that you get thrown at you. Let me briefly mention the outline for both days. So I said today we'll just do two-dimensional random geometry. And since we're going to do computer simulations, we want some simple combinatorial representation of these. And to this combinatorial representation, we want to apply Monte Carlo methods like we did for the easing model. I'll briefly describe matter coupling and its effect on the random geometries. And then I'll give you various examples of what one can actually do with them. And you'll put this into practice in the tutorial session. So this will all be two dimensions. Tomorrow, I'll focus more on higher dimensions. I'll show how the various ingredients that we need for the Monte Carlo simulation can be extended to higher dimensions. And we can really start to ask ourselves the questions whether this is saying something about gravity or not. So today, I won't mention the word quantum gravity at all. Well, maybe by accident. Tomorrow, I'll start with a brief introduction saying why this is actually might be related to quantum gravity. But it's also not the primary focus of these lectures. The primary focus is to give you all the necessary ingredients to go home after these lectures, start up your computer, write some code to actually generate random geometries according to a simple set of rules that you decide on. OK? And in the very end of tomorrow, if I have time, I'll actually mention something about quasi-dynamical triangulations, which perhaps in the last years is the most active topic of research in this direction. I've already said a few things about the tutorial sessions, but I'll go into more details at the end. OK? So what is our starting point? Well, we want to simulate some system. And we've seen how to simulate an easing model. So what was the basic philosophy behind the Ising model? We want to kind of understand a ferromagnet, which perhaps idealized we can represent by some random field of clusters of upspins and downspins. And the way we simulated this was to first discretize this model that we're actually after into some finite model, where we have lattice sides and upspins and downspins. And this is, if it's a finite model, we can explicitly write down what a probability distribution on such ingredients can be. And we can try to actually find an algorithm to generate such configurations with the desired probability. Now, we're interested in random geometry. So somehow we need the equivalent of going from this continuum field to this discrete field. And this is not entirely trivial when it comes to geometry, but there are certainly natural ways to do this. So what is geometry in the continuum? Typically, when one thinks of geometry in the continuum, one thinks of a manifold together with a metric on it. And here, the metric, I've represented it through a symmetric 2 tensor. So what does that mean? It means that if I'm at some point x, then locally my geometry, if I zoom in, it's really flat. I can look at its tangent space there. I can look at small vectors, and the tensor will tell me how long the vectors are and what their angles are. Right? And if one knows what the length of small vectors are and the angles between them, one can actually ask what distances are between points. So for instance, if I have 2 points, x and y, I can look at paths that connect y to x. And I can associate the length to such a path by chopping it into all kind of small vectors, adding up the lengths of all the vectors as given by the metric field, and that defines the length of the path for me. Then I can ask, well, among all such paths, what is the shortest one? And typically, there will be a unique such one. We call those geodesics. And the length of the geodesic is really a distance measure between x and y. So the distance between x and y. And using this metric field or the distance function, I mean, both of it contains the same information. If I have a distance function, then I can look at distances between very nearby points and I can reproduce my metric. So these are really two equivalent descriptions of a continuum geometry. So what might be a discretized version of this? Well, in the Ising model, we took these spins and basically we looked at a small neighborhood. And if we see a lot of spins that are up, let's say we just replace it, we simplify it by a single up spin, which basically corresponds to a region where everything is roughly up. So we've gone from a continuous field to a piecewise constant field, where the spin field is constant on every side of the lattice. So what if we want to consider a piecewise constant metric? Well, a natural thing to do is, what is a natural analog of a constant field? It's actually a flat metric. Or you can take your tensor field to be a constant tensor, but then okay, if you do a coordinate transformation, it will actually be a flat metric. And a flat metric, I mean just a piece of Euclidean space. So I divide up my space into regions, and within each region, I specify that the geometry is just Euclidean. Right? So here I have a square. This is a square piece of paper, basically in 2 dimensions. Why is it flat? Well, I can draw a triangle on such a piece of flat paper, like this. I mean, on paper, I have good notions of what a straight line is. And it's really flat because if I look at the angles made by all the corners of this triangle, they add up to pi, which is a good characteristic of your space being flat. Now, if I take two such regions, both are flat, and if I glue them properly, then at the intersection, this geometry will still be flat. But this won't be the case anymore when I take three or more of these chunks of Euclidean space and I start gluing them in a non-trivial fashion. So here I've taken three squares of paper, And I'm going to convince you that this is actually not a flat geometry. Because if I look at 3 points and I connect them by straight lines, still straight lines on paper, they are well defined. But if I then start looking at the angles that are made by the straight lines at the corners, now they add up to 3 pi over 2. Well, this does not happen in Euclidean space, so this is a good pointer to the fact that actually this geometry is curved. So there is actually a curvature sitting at this vertex. Okay, so what we can do is to discretize continuum random geometry is just to replace it by geometries that we can build out of pieces of flat Euclidean space. Say polygons, because those are the easiest one to glue together. Is this clear? Yes.
What about smoothness? The thing on the far right seems to have a bit of kind of similarity.
Yes, so there is no smoothness.
Oh, okay.
So we decide to give up on smoothness. I mean, there is no smoothness here in the Ising model either. So, in that sense. Now, if I build up my geometry from pieces of flat space, then I can still make sense of distances between points, because a shortest path between point X and Y is a path that is straight within each of the chunks of Euclidean space. Now, we're interested in looking at random geometries. So if we have a certain geometry, we want to change it a bit to get a different one. And there are basically two ways to do this in this picture. We can either take our polygons, our chunks of space, and deform them. Make some of the edges longer or shorter. And this is kind of the Regge calculus approach to changing geometry. The other approach is to take all these chunks of flat space to be given, have a given geometry, but start varying how do we glue them together. And this is what we're going to do. Historically, I guess this is called the dynamical triangulation approach. Even though we're not going to just look at triangles, we can take any kind of shape. So let me fix the stage. Once and for all, when we're looking at random geometries, and suppose we're taking some polygons and we're going to glue them. If we have a polygon with k sides, I'm going to assign to these polygons a geometry which is just a k regular polygon in Euclidean space. And I'm going to specify that all the edges of the polygon have length 1, because then whenever I have two polygons, I can nicely glue them, because they have same lengths of their edges. So here is a bunch of polygons. So I have some triangles, some squares, a hexagon, a pentagon. So how can I specify a geometry built out of these polygons? Well, by telling you how to glue these together. Right? So all these arrows, they tell me, OK, I want to glue this side, this polygon, to that side of that polygon. So this is a gluing prescription. Sometimes a more convenient object, combinatorial object, to describe the same amount of information is a map. So I'll be using the word map a lot. So what is a map? A map is just a graph. A graph has vertices, edges connecting vertices. But it's not just a graph, it's a graph that I draw on some surface. It can be on the blackboard. But here I've drawn it on a sphere. And this is, of course, not a combinatorial object, because there are many ways to draw a graph on a sphere. But I'm going to view this graph drawn up to deformation. So if I would draw this edge like a curly edge, as long as it does not intersect any of the other edges, I view it as being the same drawing. And I'm claiming that this drawing has the same information as this drawing, in the sense that, well, this is just the object you get by actually performing this gluing. So here is my, let's see, I have my square, that's this one, and the triangle is that one, or the triangle there. So I've actually performed the gluing, but I have not imposed on myself that I actually draw it in such a way that you can see that these are actually regular polygons, if you understand what I mean. But I agree. This is still a bit of a vague definition of what, of how I'm going to represent the geometry. So I want to make it as combinatorial as possible for you, because inherently computers are combinatorial objects. So if we want to store something like this in a computer, then we better have just something that is defined in terms of numbers. So you can't put a piece of paper into the computer, right? Yes?
Well, what are the nodes and the links and the graph on the right?
Yeah, so every link here, it corresponds to a side of, so I guess this one is this one, a side of one of the polygons, and the other side of the link corresponds to a side of a different polygon to which it's glued. And then vertices, so they correspond to. But we'll get to this, what they actually are.
Do you allow polygon to glue with itself?
Yes. But I'm not going to allow edges to be glued to it. I'm not allowed to glue a polygon, one of its sides, to the same side. But I'm allowed to glue a polygon, one side of a polygon, to the other side of that same polygon. Yes. I want a combinatorial description of these maps. And a good starting point to get such a combinatorial description is actually to figure out a way to navigate a map. And for this, I've brought along my little assistant, which is my pet mouse. And my mouse has the kind of annoying habit, or he has a bit of a fear of open spaces. So he likes to stick to the walls in his chambers. And not only that, he is also a bit asymmetric. He always likes to keep the right side of his body next to the wall. Okay. It just happens to be like this. And you can actually see this because his tail, it's a bit asymmetric. He always likes to have his tail like dragging along the wall. Okay, so suppose we have our pet here. And we want to tell our little mouse how to go to some other place in the map. And I'm allowing my mouse to take two different types of steps. There is the next step, which is, it says that my mouse, it walks to the next wall in his chamber. And then there is the adjacent step, which means he jumps over the wall and reverses his orientation. So suppose we just have these two operations. So can we now move around this map can we get everywhere we like? Well, let's see. Let's go next, next, next. So at least we can walk around the room, certainly. And we can go to the adjacent room, and we can walk around that a bit. And then we can go adjacent again and walk around. And, well, you should be convinced by now that actually it can go to all of the rooms in this map. Okay, so how does this help us actually start understanding the combinatorics of the map? Well, let's assign numbers to all the possible positions that my mouse can be in. So 1 to up to 28 here. So there are 14 edges, so there are 28 positions that the mouse can be. And then I can interpret these two operations of next and adjacent as a map from position. So if it's at 16, then next will bring him to 17. So it associates 17 to 16. And in general, next will be some permutation of all the labels that I've put on all these possible positions. Right? So this is my notation of permutation. So 1 maps to 7. Indeed, if you're here, then next goes here. 2 maps to 12. Yep. And so on. And notice it's really a permutation, because these operations are injective. You can't, there are no two positions that if you go next, you end up in the same place. So these are permutations on the integers 1 to 28. And similarly, adjacent is also a permutation on these integers. Okay. So now we can ask, well, given these permutations, how can we understand this map? So let me ask you one question first. So suppose the mouse is here. How will it determine the number of walls in his room? next until you get back, right? In general, how would you determine all the possible rooms in your house, or all the possible faces in the map, as I would call them?
You have to walk around each cell until
number of independent loops.
Yes, okay, exactly. So what does that mean in terms of the permutation N? Exactly. So permutations, we can represent them as cycles. So what is a cycle representation of permutations? So a cycle is just a set of lists of numbers where each of the numbers is mapped to the next one in the list. You're doing a cyclic permutation within each of these sets. And any permutation can be uniquely written in such a disjoint set of cycles. And for the next permutation, these cycles are exactly the rooms in the house. So the first cycle here is the one that goes 1, 7, 5, 3, 6, and then back to 1. So that's this cycle, and then we have another cycle representing this triangle. So what do these cycles of adjacent represent? 1, 27, okay, so 1 maps to adjacent, and then but 27, of course, maps back to 1. So all the cycles actually have length 2 here. So another question, how do we represent vertices in the map? And let me define a vertex as the collection of all the positions of the mouse where he points with his tail towards some. So here, so this vertex corresponds to all the mouses that have their tail pointing towards the vertex. How would we get that?
Cycles of A after N.
N after A is probably better. But okay. Otherwise, you get all the noses pointing towards the vertex. But that's fine, too, of course. It's a convention. So indeed, so let's look at this. But if we were at 4, then we could go to the adjacent one and then to the next. That would be 16. If we go from 16 to the adjacent one, it's 23. And then I go to 13. And then I go 5, 3, yes, 8. And then I'm back at 4. So all these blue arrows, the positions of the mouses, they correspond to the cycle of first doing adjacent and then doing next. Okay, so this particular cycle will be this vertex, and then you have the other vertices. Okay, so let's do another question. Given two faces, so there are two cycles, how would I determine whether they're adjacent or not? So suppose I have this face represented by this cycle and this face represented by this cycle. Then we see that in the map they're actually touching each other, which is relevant information in the geometry. Okay, yeah, that would be possible. We could see that if we take the intersection of these cycles with these cycles, we see that both one has a 4 and the other one has a 3, exactly. Slightly simpler, okay, but that does not actually say that they're directly adjacent, because this one and that one, okay, depends on your definition of adjacent. I would not call them adjacent. I'd say two faces are adjacent if they share an edge. So when do they share an edge? Yes. Exactly. So I take this my cycle representing the face, then I apply A to it. So 1 would be mapped, okay, then I see that 3 is actually mapped to 8, and 8 appears in the other one. See what I mean? Two cycles representing faces are adjacent. Exactly when A applied to one of these numbers gives one of the numbers of the other cycle. Because A maps an edge to its adjacent one, so it has to be in the other face if they're adjacent. Does this make sense? Because it's actually kind of important, because my black box that I'll give to you will actually spit out these permutations. And they're going to represent your geometries, and you're going to try to do some measurements in it. So it's kind of important that you understand how you can actually see the geometry just by having the permutations. Okay. Now something nice happens, especially in two dimensions. If I just take any permutation of numbers 1 to 2n, so where n is the number of edges, so n was equal to 14 in the previous place. So any permutation of the numbers 1 to 28, I take a pair of those, and I want to require that my adjacency permutation is a involution, meaning if I take it twice, I should be back at the identity. And also, I don't want it to have any fixed points, because that wouldn't correspond to a geometry where I glue an edge to itself, and that's not allowed. But suppose you take any such pair, and it turns out that any such pair really determines a geometry. It will have n edges, a number of faces, vertices, and that are determined by the number of cycles of these permutations. So they define some geometry on some oriented surface. So what can we say about the topology of this surface? Well, one thing that can happen is that it actually defines two disconnected surfaces. And it's connected if and only if these two permutations act transitively, meaning that any number can be mapped to any other number by any sequence of these permutations. So typically, we'll ask it to be transitive. So then we get a surface which is a connected surface, and we know from two-dimensional topology that a connected surface is characterized, the topology, by the genus, or the Euler characteristic, whichever you prefer. And Euler, he came around and said there is an easy way to calculate the genus. You just take the number of vertices minus the number of edges plus the number of faces, and that will give you 2 minus 2 times the genus. But a number of these, they're just the number of cycles of my permutation, so I know how to get them. So just from the combinatorics, I can decide what geometry I get, what topology the geometry has that I get. Oh, sorry. So now I can give you a completely algebraic description of what, say, a triangulation of the two sphere is. So what is a triangulation? A triangulation is one in which all the faces are triangles. So how do I describe this in terms of permutations? Well, it's any such pair of permutations with this property, which are transitive, meaning it has to be connected, genus 0, has to be a sphere, and all the faces have to have degree 3, which are the cycles of n. So this gives me my definition of the triangulation of the 3 sphere. I can look at quadrangulations, where all the faces have to be squares, and I only have to replace a 3 by a 4, and we can get. Can define quadrangulations of a genus 2 surface by saying that this thing has to be equal to 2. And you don't have to know anything about geometry to actually try to count these objects. You just try to count permutations. Okay. Now, one nice consequence of this fact is that one can represent these triangulations and quadrangulations in this way, is that we already know that if I fix a number of, say, triangles or a number of edges, that there can be at most a finite number of them. Because certainly number of permutations or pairs of permutations is smaller than 2n factorial squared, so it's a finite number. Now if I have a finite number of objects and I want to take a random one, then the simplest thing to do is just to take one uniformly at random. I just associate probability 1 over the number of them to each of them. And that's what we're going to do. So a random triangulation of the 2 sphere with n edges is simply a uniform random element of this set. So for n equals 60, I took a random one and I got this one. And so that's my random geometry. And we want to understand this random geometry. Is the definition clear? Okay. So what does this mean in statistical physics terms? So we're looking at a partition function, Zn, which is extremely simple. It's a sum over all possible triangulations with Boltzmann weight 1. It's just the simplest thing we can do. So the value of the partition function is just a number of triangulations of a certain size. So this is a canonical ensemble, in a sense. We're keeping the number of ingredients fixed, and we're sampling uniformly. Yes?
Could 2 of these geometries be equivalent?
Define equivalent. Not on the level of permutations by definition, because, but I'll get to this. Yes. I mean, of course, if you take a geometry and you change the labeling, the geometry can still be the same.
Yes.
I'll get to this.
So your definition of equal probability may be the same way to two configurations that are equal.
Yes. And this is a choice. There are other choices to make.
This is the microcanonical ensemble, like in which every piece has the same weight.
Sure, okay, if you like. I mean, you could also say that this is the canonical ensemble, but it just turns out that the natural Hamiltonian we use here is actually a constant one. But, okay. But I agree, it's microcanonical is perhaps better.
An equal a priori probability for each permutation.
Okay, I would say the canonical and microcanonical are the same in this setting, but this is just a matter of naming.
But does this include any degenerate geometries, like two triangles group back to back?
Yes. So I'm allowing here any geometries to be, or I mean, any gluing of edges, even if the edges sit on the same triangle, that is allowed.
But it's going to be oriented.
Yes. So the orientation is built in here in the way I encode it, because this is next permutation. I define it to give you the clockwise, anti-clockwise order on the face. So indeed, when I said that you always get an oriented surface even without these restrictions, it's really oriented. You can't get a Klein bottle or whatever. Then you have to do something more fancy. But here I'm just doing two-sphere, orientable two-sphere. Okay, so this defines a random geometry. So what is an observable? An observable is just something that associates a number to a random geometry, or a number to a geometry. And then I can ask for the expectation value, which is just the average over all these numbers over all possible geometry. Simplest thing one can do. And how are we going to compute these things? Well, there are actually various methods. In two dimensions, there is a whole zoo of methods using mathematical algorithms. One can compute many of these things exactly, using perhaps even representation theory of the permutation group, because it's clearly related to permutations or other methods. There are also methods to directly generate these random geometries without using Markov change. And secretly, I shouldn't tell you, but actually this black box I'm giving you is doing some of this fancy stuff and not actually the Markov change I'm going to talk about. But we're going to do the simple thing, which already worked in the Ising model and is prone to work here too. We're going to use a Markov chain to randomly generate these objects. And then if you generate enough random triangulations, you just sum over some number of them, you take the average, and that gives a estimate for the expectation value. OK, so we want a Markov chain. On our space of triangulations, with n edges. And we want this Markov chain to approach, after many, many steps, to a uniform distribution, because that's what we defined our random geometry to be. So this is slightly simpler than the Ising model that Gerard discussed, because he had this, not a microcanonical one, but actually a non-trivial Boltzmann weight. So he wanted a distribution which is actually non-trivial. I want a trivial distribution. And that's slightly easier. So what ingredients do we need? Let's recall from its lectures. Well, first of all, we need some kind of updating algorithm, right? So if we have some triangulation A, we need some move that changes the triangulation. So it might map it to a triangulation B, or it might not change it, or to some other triangulation. And we need, of course, this mapping not to map it to something outside of my set of triangulation. So it has to preserve the topology and the size of the triangulation. That's the first property we need. We need detailed balance, which in the absence of Boltzmann weights is really simple. It's saying that whenever I do a move from A to B, the probability of this happening should be exactly equal to the probability that B is mapped to A. That's detailed balance here. Ergodicity means that if I take any triangulation here and another triangulation there, there must be some path connecting them. And if these three properties are satisfied, then it's guaranteed that if we do enough of these moves, in the long run, we'll get a uniform triangulation of the two sphere. So now just the question is, what are these update moves? So here's a triangulation. So this is also a good example of what we're allowed to do with the triangles. So it's clear that these are triangles. Here we have two triangles which are actually glued along two of their edges, which is fine with us. Here is something more fancy happens. So I have a triangle here, one edge, two edge, three edge. So that's also a triangle. And also this thing sitting inside is also a triangle. So it has one edge, the loop, and then another edge here, and then another edge there. So it's a triangle which is glued to itself, such that the remaining edge actually becomes a loop. And this is also fine. We could choose to disallow this, but it does not help us in any way. No objections? Good. OK, so what kind of local change of the geometry might we do? Does anyone have any suggestions? If I would give you this triangulation, how would you change it?
You can swap two nodes.
Swap two nodes, like how? Well, yeah, but the triangles, they look quite similar. If I swap two...
They all have the same length.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
They're all equilateral triangles. You should keep this in mind. Yes.
So you could remove an edge, maybe one of these horizontal ones, and make it a vertical thing.
Okay, yes. So in practice, how would one do this? How do I select an edge?
Randomly.
So like this one,
yep.
For instance. And then what do I do?
Make it.
This, you mean. Yes, good. Yeah, so this is a move. I select just a random edge in my triangulation. I remove it. When I remove it, I'm left with a face of degree 4. And then I can just draw an edge, which is the different diagonal of this quadrangle. Right? And then I can do this for any edge in the triangulation, except, we don't want to do it on an edge like this, which is two sides of the same triangle, because if I would remove such an edge, then I would be left with a face of degree 1. And, that would... But on any other edge, it would work. So let's see a few more examples. So if I choose this one, and I just flip it there, choose this one, I flip it, there we go. I can even choose this edge and flip it, because if I remove it, I get a quadrangle, 1, 2, 3, 4. So it becomes this. And now I choose this edge, and you can imagine you can keep doing this. Okay, but this is just pictures, of course, and we said we're going to represent our geometry combinatorially, so we have to see what it does on the level of combinatorics. So we had labels on all our half edges, so on both sides of the edge we had a label. Now let's think of some way to update the labeling that reflects this update move. And there are various ways to do this. Yes?
Are you already aquatic with this move?
I'll come to that in the next slide.
Okay.
So one thing to do here, I have to be a bit more precise how I do this flip. I can not just remove the edge and put it back arbitrarily. So let me just select three edges, one there, 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 and cut them open, in a sense. So that's what I do here. And then I re-glue them in a different way. And effectively, I'm now flipping the diagonal. Right? And I can represent exactly, combinatorially, in terms of these permutations, what's actually happening. One thing one should notice is that on the faces, I'm not actually changing any labels. So I had 479 before and 479 after. So the new next prime will just be the same as the old one. But the adjacency relations change, and well, they really correspond to some permutation of the numbers that sit on this hexagon that I get in the intermediate stage. And if you sit down and work out, you can actually find out that it corresponds to acting with some, like, two of these three cycles on the original permutation. So on the algebraic level, this just defines my update move on permutations. Okay, so now we're going to answer Frank's questions. First of all, the first condition we need was detailed balance. So do we have detailed balance here? Okay, so if we want to answer this question, we first have to understand what is the inverse move. So here I've taken a random edge with probability 1 over the number of edges is this edge. And then the result is this configuration. Now clearly, if I want to go back, I would again have to flip this edge. So I would select that with probability 1 over the number of edges. But depending on the way I set up my updating of the labels, here I chose something which is essentially a clockwise rotation. If I do another clockwise rotation, I might actually not end up with the same labeling of this triangulation. Okay, I could choose to do with 50% probability a clockwise or anti-clockwise rotation, and then yes, I would have detailed balance. Yes.
Since there are some edges that we are actually not allowed to flip, so is that also something that prevents detailed balance? Because if I choose an edge at random, then I have a different probability in different triangulations.
No, that's not a problem. Because, suppose I select an edge that I'm not allowed to flip. Then I just don't flip. So effectively, that is a move that takes me from configuration A to back to configuration A. The inverse of this move, well, is itself. And then, of course, they have the same probability.
Okay, but if I have two triangulations, the number of edges that I'm allowed to pick and the two that can be matched by an edge can be different, right?
No, so I claim that if you have two triangulations, then there is at most one edge that you can flip in order to go from one to the other. But even that is not important, but it's true. But it's not important. The only thing required by detailed balance is that doing a move and doing the inverse move have the same probability. It does not matter whatever else you can do in these configurations. Yes?
If you happen to select an illegal edge by chance, then you just do nothing.
Yeah.
It's a move, right?
It's a move, and
so
it automatically.
Oh, it's one over.
Yes.
It looks like you don't have the balance because of this chirality of the move, of the update. But then if you apply it twice, you go to.
Okay, yes. So let's keep that thought, and I'll get to that in 10 seconds. Okay, so, detailed balance is not quite satisfied here, but almost. If I would do it clockwise, anticlockwise, with equal probability, then it would be okay. So how about ergodicity? Why is this not ergodic by a long stretch?
You don't change the number of edges.
No, but I'm doing simulations with a fixed number of edges. My set of triangulations has a fixed number of edges. So that's fine.
You're not changing the number of triangles.
Okay, if you do the combinatorics, you'll see that if you fix a number of edges, you also fix a number of triangles. So that's also not a problem.
But edges that you can't move versus move, so you cannot change that part.
That's also not a problem. you can do some other moves first, and then you will be able to change them. So what else? Think of the labeling. What did my update do with my next permutation? What was n prime?
Oh.
Yeah, it's a concept. It does not change at all. So, of course, this thing is not ergodic. Right? If you start with permutation n and you never change it, then it's not going to explore the whole space of permutations, right? Sometimes answers are kind of easier than you guess. Okay, so when is this ergodic? Well, we can, of course, do the flip of the edge, and then afterwards randomly change all the labels in my triangulation. Right, I can just select a random permutation of two n integers and just apply it afterwards. I'm taking two steps, one and then two, and I define this to be my new move. So why does this satisfy detailed balance and ergodicity? So first, detailed balance. Well, I mean, if I first do this move and then I go here and I just shuffle the indices I have, I just have this just the structure of the triangulation. And the probability that they end up in a particular state will, with these particular labels, will be just 1 over 2 n factorial, the number of labels, plus the probability, times the probability that I select the correct edge. And the same is true for the reverse move. Okay? So detailed balance is fine. So why is this ergodic? Well, you have to do a proof to show this. And I guess the first one who did this was Wagner in the 30s. So you just have to be able to show that any triangulation of the sphere, by performing these moves, you can reduce it to some canonical triangulation. And if you can do this for any such triangulation, you can reduce it to the canonical one, and from the canonical one, you go back to any other one. And this requires some pages of, I don't know. Okay. First flipping, changing all the labels, has detailed balance, and it's ergodic. Yes?
So just to clarify, this non-detailed balance, non-ergodicity is arising because of putting arbitrary labels on this, whereas in fact, geometrically, when I do that move twice again, it's just the same thing back. So it's just because of that arbitrariness that you attach, putting these numbers that you get one no in the first part.
Yes. So this is an artifact having the labels there. But next slide, I'll actually show why we have the labels there. Apart from the fact that we actually want to put this thing in the computer. And okay. But of course, I mean, if you want to do a simulation, you don't want to do a small little move and then have to change all the labels in your whole configuration. So in practice, we don't do this. So why is it okay not to do this? Well, the main ingredient here is that if you perform a flip and then change all the labels, it's the same as first changing all the labels and then doing a flip. These two operations commute. And not only that, if I change all the labels and then again I change all the labels, that's the same as only changing the labels once. Right? I guess you agree with that too. So instead of taking my simulation and do flip, label change, flip, label change, flip, label change. I could do a flip, flip, label change, flip, flip, label change. Or I could just do flip, 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 and at the end do a label change. This will not change the distribution of the geometry I get in the end. You see, I mean, if these two operations commute, then I can do them in any order, so I can do all the label changes at the end, and then I can just replace it by one single label change. But in practice, we don't even do this last label change because we're lazy. I mean, why would we do this label change at the end? It's because we want to sample a random geometry and then we want to do some measurement on it. But we can also just require that when we do this measurement, that the measurement is actually invariant under permutations of labels. So if we restrict to this requirement, then we don't have to do any permutations at all. So we just do the flips. And no matter, so if you do a many, many, many flips, we'll get some random geometry in this space. It will be far from the uniform geometry with labels, but we always know if we perform a random permutation of the labels, we'll actually get this uniform geometry. Okay. That is the takeaway message here. And from now on, we're going to completely disregard labels. But they're there. So let me mention, get back to this question of why the labels. Labels because we want our computer to understand these things. But there is one more reason. The reason mathematically that we want to have labels on our object is that it kills all possible symmetries that our system might have. And this is typically a good thing. So let's see why this is a good thing. And so we have to look at the alternative. So what would be the alternative to label triangulations? Well, unlabeled triangulations. So how would I define unlabeled triangulations in the combinatorial fashion? I would just say take a labeled triangulation and look at the equivalence class of all these labeled triangulations under relabelings. Right? So let me these are the labeled triangulations, and T tilde are the unlabeled ones. They correspond to equivalence classes under the relation given by relabeling. So two triangulations are the same unlabeled triangulation if there is a permutation of the labels that brings one to the other. And we could define a random geometry as being sampling just one of these uniformly in the unlabeled triangulations. But it turns out this is not the same thing as taking a uniform labeled triangulation and forgetting about the labels. Okay, so why is that? So let me write down the partition function for labeled triangulations with these Boltzmann weights equal to 1. Then since my space partitions into equivalence classes, I can just rewrite this sum as a sum over the equivalence classes and then a sum over the elements weighted by 1. So that's just the size of the equivalence class. So what is the size of our equivalence class? It's given one labeled triangulation in this equivalence class, it's asking in how many ways can it permute the labels to get a different labeled triangulation. Now generally one would expect, okay, if you have 2n labels, there are 2n factorial ways of moving around my labels. But this is only true if the geometry has no symmetries. If it has internal symmetries, if there is some symmetry that rotates, let's say, by 180 degrees, then two such proposed labelings will actually give the exact same label triangulation. So in fact, the number of ways one can relabel a label triangulation is 2n factorial divided by the size of the automorphism group of this geometry. So the number of symmetries of the object. And if you now interpret this as a partition function on unlabeled triangulation, I mean it's a sum over unlabeled triangulation, which are these equivalence classes, we see that it's not a trivial Boltzmann weight anymore. It's actually weighted by a Boltzmann weight proportional to 1 over the size of this automorphism group. So it's not a uniform unlabeled triangulation. I mean, notice this 2n factorial is irrelevant. I mean, it's the same for all of them. So it's really this part that introduces the bias. So one can say, why did you make this choice? So let me tell you why. Suppose that we did want to sample uniform unlabeled triangulations using Monte Carlo method, say. But actually the same argument is true for any kind of technique you use to do this. So here are two unlabeled triangulations. One of them has a lot of symmetries, and the other one has fewer symmetries. So this one only has 180 degree symmetry. And we want to sample them with equal probability. So if we would do a Monte Carlo simulation, we would try to do some update there. So let's say a flip of one of these diagonals. And we want to ensure detailed balance. So this is configuration A, configuration B, and I want to know the probability of going to A to B and from B to A. Now, the probability to go from this triangulation to that triangulation is, well, you can only flip this edge. So that's 1 over the number of edges. Right? But suppose you're starting here, and then you ask, OK, and how many, I mean, what is the probability of going from here to there? Guess?
One,
yes. No matter what edge you flip here, you'll end up in this triangulation. So if I want to make the detailed balance here, so the probability should actually be the same when going this direction and that direction, I have to introduce an acceptance rate. And this acceptance rate in this direction should be 1 over n. Because this probability is 1 over n, and this was 1, but OK, and then I have to accept it with 1 over n. Now, OK, that might slow down the simulation a bit, but that wouldn't actually be too bad. What would be bad is that if you're doing the simulation, you actually have to calculate the fact that you have to do this acceptance rate, right? So suppose you're in this situation and you want to do a flip and you want to determine what should be the acceptance probability, then you need to do two things. First, you have to explore your full triangulation where you're at, count all the symmetries it has. Then you have to try this flip move and see how many symmetries are left in the end. And then you have to do some algebra and you find an acceptance rate. Well, you really want them to do this.
So when you relate dynamic progress on a Feynman diagram, like to prove to the, which is the one corresponding to Feynman diagram, labeled one, weighted different?
I mean, in practice, anything you'll generate with any kind of model will be of the labeled type. Well, either labeled or having this factor in. So if you do a Feynman expansion, you always have this, automatically, this bias. Yeah. And so that's also the reason we have it here. Yeah.
Are you talking about a technical problem of how to sample one distribution versus the other, and you prefer one because it's easier? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So, but these two distributions, as you say, they are not equivalent.
Yes.
So there might be the right one, or the one that fits the purpose of something else. Since you didn't tell us why you want to sample, we don't know at this stage, right?
But no, sure. Okay.
It seems to me that you cannot choose the simple one just because it's simple.
Well, I would say in simulations, yes, we can choose, and that is the main driving factor. But okay, let me answer your question then. In the end, it doesn't matter. If I sample a triangulation with either of these distributions with 1,000 triangles, the probability that it will actually have some symmetries is negligible. So yeah, I mean, the geometries you will produce at very large will be the same. But if you want to prove that your algorithm actually satisfies detailed balance and such, you have to take this into account. Yeah, so the main message here is if you're going to do simulation with random geometries, either you have to take them just labeled, or you have to introduce this factor, because otherwise I'll assure you you run into problems. I think it's a good time for a break. We're an hour in now, right? Yeah. Okay, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, what is the... 15, okay, so then we'll start again at 1 to 10.